In this age of hybrids and straight electric cars, we get very different sounds from our vehicles from what we used to get. There's still a sense of expecting vroom when we go. If we get some other sound or sense, we worry and think about taking the car or truck to the shop. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive, and he's our partner in a monthly segment we call the Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you are the squeaky wheel. Give us a call or email to talk about automotive issues you've had or are currently having. Again, it's 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Zach Edwards, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Jeffrey. Good to be here.
Do you get an uptick in business, I wonder, as the weather turns hotter? I mean, do radiator parts fail and things like that in people's cooling systems?
Yeah, we do. It always is a busier time of the year heading into summer. And I think that's probably twofold. One is that heat definitely is an enemy of the car. And two, people are thinking about traveling and thinking about vacationing and wanting to get everything ready before the summer season. So, yeah, we definitely get busier.
No doubt. I actually have a question now about diesels that occurs to me because I used to own one, and it seemed like when the coolant system was malfunctioning just a little bit so that the overall average engine temperature rose a little higher, that the diesel seemed to work a lot more efficiently on fuel. I mean, I'm not recommending this to anybody, but have you observed anything like that yourself?
That a hotter engine
burns more efficiently for a diesel.
It works for gasoline engines too, mm-hmm. Which is essentially why the strategy of modern engines is to get warmed up as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. because that is going to a warmer engine does burn more efficiently and it conserves fuel, and I think it works with diesels that way too. Diesels generally run cooler than a gasoline engine, but they do want to get warm as quickly as possible so that they can run a leaner mixture.
Yeah.
And, I also wanted to say real quick, talking about the heat, I just couldn't help but think of a couple of colleagues of mine down in Arizona.
Uh-huh.
They always say that engines just melt down there, uh-huh. coming in the summertime. I mean, they see catastrophic engine failures like we don't see here.
Uh-huh.
But yes, the radiators just explode and, engines melt down when they're not lubricated properly in that type of heat. So we're not in the Arizona level, I guess, but definitely that shows how destructive heat can be, especially when it gets that hot.
I reminded again of the close tolerances. A friend, a neighbor, had his lawnmower apart recently, and it just doesn't look like there's any space whatsoever between the piston and the cylinder walls. And granted, that was a lawnmower engine, but I can't imagine it's any different on automotive engines. You have told us very often how tight a fit that really is, and if the lubrication breaks down for whatever reason, you're really looking at some trouble.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure some of the modern tolerances are in 0.001",
mm-hmm.
so just a film of oil is all that can ever be in between those two parts that are rotating at several thousand times per minute. So you can understand if you miss an oil change, and essentially what's happening to your oil is it breaks down and loses its viscosity, and if that happens, and you put those numbers together at 0.001" and 2,000 RPMs, damage happens very quickly.
So what does a piston look like when you guys do a complete engine overhaul and you pull it out? I mean, are they kind of pitted and scarred? I mean, are little bits of gunk get in there and score the pistons?
Well, we don't really get to do engine overhauls anymore, mm-hmm. because of that exact nature. I mean, it's just so precise that engine and transmission overhauls oftentimes now are happening in clean facilities that have electrostatically charged air so that, there's no dust, because the cleanliness factor is so important. But we have, for the purposes of diagnosing problems, we have disassembled engines down to the point where we can find piston damage, and you can see literally, aluminum melting or aluminum alloys melting from not being cooled properly or lubricated properly. And it's pretty impressive when you see a catastrophic breakdown such as that. I mean, it just makes you realize how hot these combustion chamber temperatures are and how important the lubricant is.
Yeah, if we're talking aluminum in particular, it's got a lower melting point than steel, but it still requires a few thousand degrees, I think. I'm going to have to look that up, the melting point of aluminum. But if you're starting to get stuff melting, that's not a good thing.
No, not at all.
So I wanted to ask you about, Zach, about, people who are thinking, okay, you know what, with the pandemic, we have to do social distancing, because we don't want to be around people, can't do a big group trip. Let's go off into the backcountry with our, by the way, the melting point of aluminum, 1,221 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
So there you go. But going backcountry, though, and I noticed this in sort of a cross-reference with I forget which maker it is. It's coming out with an off-road vehicle to go against the Jeep Wrangler. But it was mentioning things like rock plates and stuff like that. I mean, if you're going to take a car into a place that's seriously off the beaten track, and I don't mean a car, I mean, some taller vehicle, but what kinds of things should you consider if you're going to be going way out in a place that's got big rocks and unstable surfaces and not very close to a mechanic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the most important things is tires. And tires, even though they can look good, you could have good tread depth, and maybe not that many miles on your tires, but if your tires are older, 6 or 7 years is kind of the usable life nowadays of rubber. In the tire application. And so if you're driving on a back road, the washboard is a real common thing to encounter out there, or big, deep craters or holes that you're driving across. And so you combine that type of surface, rough surface, with some speed, and you can have a blowout out there, which is, it's going to ruin your day at the very least. And so I would encourage anybody who's going to do that to just, you can inspect your tires yourself, or if you're not really sure what you're looking at, you could go into your shop and have them just take a look. They should be looking at that anyway if they're doing an oil change or something. So that's a really important thing. And then the other thing to consider, I guess, is that if you're pretty active, like so many people are around here and driving the back roads of Oregon, you're just going to wear out shocks and bushings and suspension type of components more quickly, and keeping up on those types of repairs in real time instead of letting them go unrepaired for long periods. If you keep up on those types of repairs, it's going to really help the rest of the car out as well, just because a lot of those components absorb the hits when you're driving on an irregular road surface.
Mm-hmm.
And then just encourage people that not necessarily bomb through the woods. You got to kind of slow down on those roads, because these roads are very remote, and some of them are extremely rough. I can think of the old, like going up to the Upper Klamath in those rafting vans,
uh-huh.
and how rough that road down, to the put-in point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's like 20 miles of washboard and mountain, just really rough road surfaces, and it's just really hard on a car, but they can take it as long as you just have to replace things as they break.
All right, so it's going to be more frequent replacements of things like shocks and bushings and struts, I guess.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, does it help when people get to describe the clunking that they're hearing if a bushing or a strut is wearing out?
Yeah, and suspension noises can be one of the most difficult things to diagnose from a technician standpoint, because you can have maybe 4 or 5 different things that can fail, but they sound the same when they fail. And of course, it's under the car, and you're oftentimes having to drive the car to simulate the noise.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to listen to something happening under the car, And so there's been some new tools that have come out that are really, really helpful in diagnosing suspension noises. They're clamps that clamp on, and then they transmit into headphones that you can listen to different parts of the car amplified. And nowadays, they're actually turning those sounds into waveforms so that you can see the waveform of the noise, and they've mapped out what this type of material, the waveform it's going to make versus a different type of component made out of a different type of material. And so it's really, really helpful because it can just be very difficult. And oftentimes with a suspension system, multiple parts are worn out anyway, mm-hmm. all at the same time. And so, of course, the customer is primarily interested in the worn out part that's making the noise. And it can be difficult when multiple parts really need to be changed, but you're working on a budget. So it's just one of those complicated parts of our industry.
Right. So with the suspension parts, you generally tend to say, look, you know, I can replace the one, but you really want one, two, three, these parts all replaced at once because the other two are going to go pretty soon anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where the communication comes in, where you really, you know, fixing the car is only half the battle. The other half is effectively communicating with the customer. What we try to do is just present all the information we have so that the customer can then just make their own decision, and we will help guide them or steer them in the right direction. But
no pun intended, steer them.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be just like you said, where, hey, this car needs, actually all of these things are worn out. We're not sure if this is going to fix it. I hate to tell you, but we just can't be sure until we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a sticky situation.
No doubt. We're talking to Zach Edwards here on this month's edition of The Squeaky Wheel. Zach is the owner of Ashland Automotive, and he joins us once a month to answer our automotive questions, and they need not all be my questions. You can certainly share a story of vehicle woe of your own or ask a question about something you might have seen or heard under your vehicle or on top of your vehicle or dragging behind your vehicle. We're not really particular about direction either. Join us with your phone calls at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. When I hear about things like the technicians being able to put on headphones and look at visual waveforms and stuff like that, I just realize how much things have changed from what car repair used to be like. Do you guys even have creeper boards at a modern facility like the one you just moved into?
Yeah, most of my guys do. Every once in a while, it's just easier to roll underneath the vehicle. And sometimes, with the case of suspension parts, you actually want the vehicle's suspension to be loaded or
have the weight of the car on it. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And so you'll need to roll underneath there to maybe pry on a couple of spots or pull on a couple of spots and try and simulate a rattle or a clunk or something. So yeah, they do, but the creepers definitely get used a lot less than in the old days.
No doubt. I was wondering about that, though, because it seems like there are so many different ways you can lift and twist and spin a car now, but you also got to do it the old-fashioned way sometimes. Coming back to the driving off-road things, I just wonder what kinds of surprises that people have gotten from thinking that their vehicles might have been tougher than they actually turned out to be. I mean, have you had, like, rocks piercing oil pans and things like that?
Yeah, the Volkswagens were, for a while there, the Jettas and the Beetles that came out in the early 2000s were coming in. They had an aluminum oil pan, and it didn't have any protection. And I'll tell you, the road up to Pilot Rock Trailhead is especially brutal on aluminum oil pans, we found. And so there's actually an oil pan skid plate that you can buy. It's an aftermarket to install on those rigs. That's a pretty common one. And then, ball joints can just break on some of these roads as well. And oftentimes if you have a ball joint break, your whole tire is just going to come off of the car. And so fortunately, it's usually a slow speed thing on these rough roads. But, you know, the damage can be done on the road, the slow-going rough road, and then it can present itself when you get back on the freeway to head home from the old gravel road. And so it's really a tough spot to be in, and I just can't emphasize enough how your trusted regular shop should be able to help you just with doing regular oil changes and whatnot, mm-hmm. catch some of these things before they become very problematic and safety or hazardous for anybody and everybody on the road, really. And, you know, like you mentioned, people are really driving a lot more now than before. Nobody's flying right now, mm-hmm. or very rarely, and so a lot of people are hitting the roads.
Right, because the safest vehicle is the one with you and your family in it, rather than getting into a tube with a lot of other people.
Yeah, and I've heard that the campgrounds are packed, and Oregonians and Californians are using up our resources, which is really great. But I think that auto shops like mine and everybody else right now, we're extremely busy.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of it's a little bit overwhelming at times, and it's strange times. So
yeah, really. So that's right. I hadn't even thought about that. More vehicle usage, more visits to you guys. So are you getting longer wait times to get people into the shop?
Yep. And of course, then we have. And the challenges of, we have the same challenges with the workforce that, you know, a lot of our staff, they have kids, and they're wondering what are they going to do in the next couple of weeks when school is supposed to be starting. And I would definitely encourage people to plan ahead, make that appointment now if they want to get their car looked at. Because oftentimes parts need to be ordered as well. And so it's not just getting the appointment set, you got to allow time for the repair process to happen. And oftentimes that's actually a couple of weeks, depending on the availability of parts. And of course, parts availability right now is a little bit strained.
That was my next question, is if the supply chain has gotten damaged there.
Supply chain, and then, you know, a lot of the parts are manufactured in China. Even German car parts are oftentimes manufactured in China in a German facility. Shipping and manufacturing and all of the other things that go with that are just really, you know, straining our industry. And, so things are just, as a result, things are just taking a little bit longer and, it's always a bummer when somebody misses a couple of days of their vacation because of a car related thing, but it's not that uncommon, I hate to tell you.
All right. Zach Edwards, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange for the Squeaky Wheel. You can join in by phone or email 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. When people are on the road, they've had a chance to see you. Everything seems to be fine with the car, but they're noticing they think the car is running a little hot. I mean, do most vehicles just have the idiot lights now that just tell you, like, hey, your radiator is about to boil over? Or do we have generally the heat gauges for the engine?
I would like to say maybe it's a 50-50, mm-hmm. but more and more, and definitely the trend is leaning or headed toward just the warning light that comes on at a certain temperature,
mm-hmm.
Which... You know, I have mixed feelings about. I like to see my gauge, but I have to say my own car doesn't have one anymore.
Huh.
I just kind of have to trust it, trust that everything's okay until it's not. What one person might say to defend the light versus the gauge is that the gauges weren't actually that accurate anyway.
Oh, really?
So what would happen is your gauge... We'd like to think that your gauge would slowly start to creep up, as, say, in the case of your engine coolant temperature, the gauge would slowly start to creep up, and some of them would, but oftentimes the gauge would just go from resting right there in the middle to, you know, skyrocketing to the red line,
mm-hmm.
very, very quickly, and it really only would give you 10 seconds before you're showing as very overheated. And so... Essentially, that's the same as a light coming on. That's what a lot of, I think, engineers would argue as to why the gauge is relatively, you know, useless compared to just having a warning light that comes on. And the other thing is the calibration of the sensors, which connected to those gauges, oftentimes over time, they would slowly become out of calibration. And so the accuracy of that gauge reading was always in question anyway.
So, keep an eye. Let me get a question here before we go. Bob and Hugo, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Zach Edwards on the Squeaky Wheel.
Morning. I have a Toyota 87 truck, four-cylinder, and I only drive it maybe once a month, and when I try to start it, it takes forever. So I use starting fluid. Is there any problem with that?
Is it an 87, is that carbureted, or has that got the 22RE?
Carburetor.
Carburetor, yeah.
Well, starting fluid isn't the best thing for an engine. You want to definitely use small amounts of it. My guess is that the choke mechanism might be malfunctioning on that, and that has an electric choke, I believe. But another thing that could be at play is if you only drive it once a month, the gasoline just doesn't last very long. The shelf life of gasoline is not going to hold up over a long period of time. And so if you have the same tank of fuel for months and months and months, you're going to want to use a fuel stabilizer in there and maybe even switch to the ethanol-free fuel. Mm-hmm. And that should help you with some of those rough starts.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would, starting fluid's not the best thing. You kind of want to use it as little as possible.
All right. Thanks for the question, Bob. Appreciate that. And Zach, I'm always impressed by your encyclopedic knowledge of vintages of cars, particularly from the 80s.
Yeah, I know. I am too, actually.
All right. Zach Edwards from the Squeaky Wheel, Ashland Automotive. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks, Jeffrey.